listening to Kent Biz Connect, the show that connects businesses in Kent to do business. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Well, good afternoon, listener, and thank you very much for joining us for another bi-weekly Kent Biz Connect radio show with myself, Martin White, and today...
Hello, everyone, it's Tracy.
You don't sound like Brian.
No, he's sunning himself somewhere in Cyprus.
Tracy, thank you so much for stepping in. I know they're big shoes to fill.
Oh, yes. Size 11.
Even bigger jeans. But we won't get into that. Brian, I'm sure you're listening in. I hope you're having a lovely time out there, sunning yourself. We've got a fabulous packed show again today. We've got two amazing studio guests with us. To my right, we've got...
David McKeown from Absolute Protection Group.
Dave, welcome to the studio. I know it's your first time.
It is.
And next to you?
Mohamed Ziada from Fast Science Maidstone.
Mo, welcome to the studio. Great to have you guys with us on such a dark, sort of rainy, wet day. Another rainy day in November. But we shall try and brighten the mood, Tracy, won't we, today?
We will try to, but...
Oh, dear.
We have been scouring the papers for some business news.
Oh, gosh. And, well, you and I were at a business event this morning, weren't we, bright and early?
We
were guests of the FSB in Kent at the fabulous Macnaids in Faversham, which is, how would you describe it?
Do you know, I think it's just such a really nice family-run business.
Right.
And they provide local foods.
A lot of it is local,
yes,
isn't it? That apple juice was from Canterbury, I noticed.
It was, yes. So a lot of the stuff that they actually sell in Faversham is all locally produced. Mm. And obviously they have some specialist stuff as well as their meat counter and specialty cheeses, all of these things. So, yes. Really lovely breakfast as well this morning.
I couldn't believe how busy it was. It's a sort of an artisan kind of food outlet, isn't it? I mean, it stocks a whole variety of things from sort of fresh fruit and veg through to, you know, apple juice and wine, I think, and all sorts of stuff. But it's all done in the best possible taste, literally, isn't it? Because it just tastes amazing.
I know, and it was very busy in the cafe when we left.
Yeah, so a great example. Of a sort of family-run business catering very much for a local community and wherever possible minimising kind of carbon miles from, I don't know, from orchard to, you know, to plate, for example.
Yes. And I know you were really going on about their tomatoes.
Oh, those tomatoes to die for, weren't they? They could have been flown in from Sicily fresh that morning. They were just gorgeous. So anyway, thank you, FSB. Thank you, Macnaids, for hosting us this morning. We really enjoyed that. It does mean we've been up since the crack of dawn, however.
Yes, yes.
So we'll try and hold it together today,
Tracy.
We will.
We've had our coffee as well. So, you know, this show could go one of two ways.
Now, you've had your eye on the news, you were saying, before I interrupted you.
Yes, yes. Well, obviously, you know, not that I like to rain gloom and doom onto our listeners, but obviously this morning we had in the news that Clinton stores are going to be facing closure. Another business from the high street going to a CVA, which is a company voluntary arrangement, and they're trying to seek... to reduce their payments to their landlords at the moment. But, you know, there's 66 branches that they're looking to close and they're negotiating with over 200 landlords. So it's going to be quite a big impact, I think, for Kent because we've got stores all over the place, really. Canterbury, Sittingbourne, Maidstone, Folkestone, Tunbridge Wells, Rochester and Gillingham. And it's going to be affecting quite a lot of staff in them areas. Mm. And this time of year, it's not really a nice thing.
Where are people buying their cards if they're not buying them at Clinton Cards then? I mean, what are the kind of options for people when it comes to greetings cards today?
I don't know, actually. I mean, there's a lot of competition out on the high street. Mm. I know that Clinton's a few years ago... opened a few shops which had more basic cards, so they were a lot cheaper than their normal ranges. But I'm not really 100% sure what's gone wrong here, apart from the fact that maybe people are not sending cards so much, or there's a lot of other businesses out there that are selling cheaper cards.
What about you guys? I mean, let's open this up. Where do you buy your, you know, birthday cards, things like that? I mean, when you, I mean, we don't buy them very often, I guess, and that's maybe one of the problems. But when you need to buy a nice card for your wife, for example, for your anniversary or a birthday for a child, where do you buy them?
I think it's one of the options last few years is the online, actually, okay, and somehow, because it's giving you good prices and more options. So I think this is one of the reasons why everybody is going to online.
Online. So what? So you buy, you commission a physical card, but online, like is it Moonpig and people
like
that?
Yes, and then they post it for you, so you don't even have to worry about that.
But obviously you can't write in it that way, can you? So.
No, even they have a facility even. What kind of message? And they do it for you, and they post, they do everything
so
for you.
So you can handwrite a message, and they'll scan that in and imprint it on the card or something.
Yeah, it's better than my font, actually, on the card.
Okay, that's interesting. What about you, Dave? Where do you?
I would tend to go to a shop,
a specialist shop like Clinton,
or a garage.
Probably.
Well, there you go.
Just to pick up them flowers as well.
That's it. Yeah, never forget the flowers. No, I would probably take a trip into somewhere like Clinton's. I wouldn't guarantee Clinton's, but a shop similar.
Yeah,
it's a rarity that I would go out actively and look for a card. If I'm honest. But I do sort of agree with Mo that the online sales has probably picked up because you can personalise them to that person. So you can take a picture off your phone and send that in, and that can be on the card.
I didn't even know you could do that.
We need to teach you.
and I guess you'd struggle to create that at home, wouldn't you? Because, you know, our graphic design skills aren't necessarily up to the job. But you can send someone a picture and they'll make a card
for
you.
So it's fully personalised.
Yeah.
At which point you can't do that in Clinton's.
No.
So.
And it's not just cards, is it? Because it's mugs. And I remember a friend of mine recently gave me a mug to remind me of a time when he beat me on the golf course. One of those rare occasions where he'd actually beaten me on the golf course. And for my 50th birthday this year, he gave me a mug with his picture on and a very rude message about the fact that he'd beaten me. So you're right, I guess, and stuff like that, you could never make that at home, could you?
Yeah, it's like packages, actually. Mm. They more options, actually. Sometimes they give you ideas.
Right.
Because in some certain times, you reach a level, what kind of card, in every season. So you want a new idea. And I think the online, some of them, they are really creative.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Plus, also, you can get a birthday card in December. So if anybody has a family member or a friend whose birthdays are in key areas of the year, like Valentine's Day and Easter and Christmas, then you can actually go online and actually find a really nice birthday card. Whereas if you walk into a card shop, it's wall-to-wall Christmas cards at the moment. Yep. So, and the array of the nice birthday cards are not really available because they're gearing up to Christmas. So,
well, I think without knowing it, on the back of this discussion, we've probably put the final nail in the coffin for Clinton. it wasn't our intention, but you've certainly opened my eyes up to a whole new world of opportunity.
There
we are. I think it's fair to say then, in summary, that perhaps the market has evolved somewhat.
I mean, retailers have had a really awful year this year. Reading an article in the Retail Gazette today, the amount of businesses that have gone under, KPMG released that 44 retail businesses entered administration in just 6 months leading up to September this year. And you're looking at people like, LK Bennett, which, Catherine, she wore a lot of their dresses as well, which really boosted sales. But I think that they started to get on that bandwagon by increasing prices for their clothing and everything else based on the fact that Catherine, the Duchess of Cambridge, was wearing a lot of their stuff. Office Outlet, they went in March. Debenhams, obviously a lot of stores have closed now, but that was back in April. You're looking at Forever 21 for that fast fashion retailer. They closed back in September.
Mothercare?
Mothercare, that's last week. Bonmarché in October.
Mm.
So, you know, and obviously Mamas and Papas on the 8th of November. So there is a big trend there. And I know that Mothercare in Canterbury, Orpington and Bluewater today has got their massive closing down sale. So if you need anything... from Mothercare, get down there now because they are actually selling everything off. Obviously, they're trying to make as much revenue as possible.
Well, there was some negative press about that, wasn't there? Because I think loads of people rocked up at Mothercare in Canterbury last week expecting, because they'd announced that they were going to have this massive closing down sale and everything was going to be heavily discounted. And then people got there and it wasn't.
It's today.
It's today.
It's actually today.
Oh, okay.
That they've got the closing down sale. Right.
So these are very traditional businesses that have traditionally had a high street presence.
For a long time as well. I mean, Mothercare's been on the high street for a long, long time. Debenhams, I mean, that was a stalwart of our high streets. And, you know, where the real issues lie, I think it's a... more than one thing. I think they're obviously the online side of things has really taken hold. But also, you know, there's been conversations about whether or not in key areas and likes of London and key cities, whether or not the landlords that own the premises to which these businesses are in have actually, you know, taken the cream, you know, and increased all their rates and rents and everything, which has obviously stifled the cash flow.
Well, business rates, I think, are always a bone of contention for most business owners with premises, aren't they, I guess?
Yes.
And Paul, we were with Paul Andrews this morning, and Paul was talking about the fact that I think Canterbury, they're about to hike the business rates in Canterbury again. And you think, you know, there's only so much that prospective business owners with premises are gonna kind of take of that. And you think, well, you know, if actually, you know, you see businesses and in particular kind of not just high street brand names, but all businesses as the kind of the centre of the community, really, in terms of its prosperity and giving people a reason to want to live somewhere. And then you start kind of... chopping their legs off, you know, with kind of hugely inflated and unrealistic business rates, then where does that, you know, where's that going to end up?
I mean, I think that it would be nice to change the whole aspect of our high street because if you take the high street back to, you know, even 100 years ago, there was a lot of family-run businesses in a high street. You'd go to a specific high street and then if you went to the next high street town, you wouldn't necessarily get the same products because it was all very bespoke, you know, for whatever businesses were in that town at the time. Whereas the likes of places like, you know, for Debenhams, for instance, they're in a lot of big towns. And then you've got your Marks and Spencers, you know, all of these big, even Primark, Boots, they're all in one town. Now, if they all go, then you've not got a lot left. But I think this is a fantastic opportunity for local authorities and landlords in these towns to get together and work with family businesses, work with small SMEs and come up with a scheme that can fill these shops that are empty, have a bit of revenue and to actually have a fantastic, vibrant high street now with more bespoke and really nice little shops, you know, and little cafes that you go.
Because there are businesses, like you say, that are bucking the trend. I mean, there was another article we were reading about micro pubs. You know, and how micro pubs are kind of bucking the trend on two levels, really. Firstly, on a kind of a high street kind of, you know, retail level, because that's generally where they tend to be. There's no point, you know, having a micro pub unless it's a destination kind of gastro pub out in the middle of nowhere. You know, they're generally in kind of popular towns.
I mean, some of them have taken over, like the Flipping Frog in Rochester. I love that name. Now, that's been a micro pub since December 15. And that was, that took over an old pizza shop.
Right.
So they've done that up.
And where you know traditional pubs are closing, you know, by the dozen, they're actually bucking the trend on that level as well, and they're managing to be, you know, very very successful because I think of the product ultimately that they're selling, and quite often they'll also brew their own, you know, beer on the premises. You know, some of them, so they're kind of micro breweries as well as kind of micro pubs at the same time.
Oh yes, and I know that one of the pubs in Ken is actually on second on the list of the Camera best micro pubs in the UK.
Right.
You know, Kevin, my business partner, he's very much into his real ales. Mm. And he actually goes around and looks at all of these places. And I have to say that it has a completely different feel to a normal sort of like big pub like your Wetherspoons, et cetera. And it is quite a little community.
Yeah.
You can sit and chat. Some of them have strict rules where you're not allowed to have your mobile phone on or, you know, take phone calls. Otherwise, you get penalised and fined and you put, you know, a few quid in their charity jar. But I quite like what they've done and what they've done to convert some of these empty premises that have, you know, stood empty for a long time and reignited a business from that empty property.
So you can make it work, but you've ultimately, you know, like in like with any business, you've got to find something that you can own and give people a reason to want to spend money in your shop or pub or whatever it is. That's what any good marketing is all about, isn't it? Giving someone a reason to want to come in and spend money. And you know, clearly, you know, with the internet and the way things are evolving there constantly and day to day, you know, people like Clinton Cards just haven't been able to kind of to move their business in that direction.
Yeah, so I think that a lot of businesses are finding it very difficult because, you know, the internet and everything else on online shopping has moved very, very quickly. But there is also this question to be called on, especially fast fashion. You know, there is the economic side of things, but there's also the wastage because people are buying stuff, wearing it two or three times, and then it's going to landfill. Where does it stop? You know, it's nice to have something a bit unique to wear because I know I've been to places where I've rocked up in a really nice frock and somebody the other side of the room's got exactly the same frock on than I have and probably does look better in it than I do. But to find a shop that will give you something that's more unique, I think a lot more people would be interested to have a rifle through the clothes rails on them kind of places.
Yes.
And especially I know a lot of businesses do a lot of upcycling. Them kind of businesses are doing very well because a lot of people have got on that bandwagon of upcycling things that they've got in their home as well.
You're absolutely right because you know, with the likes of Amazon and people like that, I think just comes a whole new level of waste. You know, when you buy something that costs a few quid on Amazon and it doesn't work anymore, you know, you look at it and you think, can I really be bothered to take this back to the post office, put it in a box, send it off to get my money back, or shall I just chuck it in the bin?
Well, nine times out of ten, it costs you more to send it back than it did to buy it in the first place.
So with all of that comes this huge kind of waste and everything sort of becoming very commoditized. Whereas, as you say, if you know, when it comes to clothing, when it comes to the beer you drink, you know, or the wine you drink, or the you know, the McNaid shopping experience, for example, you know, that's an experience.
Yes.
You know, people go there to kind of, you know, to buy products that perhaps, you know, they would never find anywhere
you
else.
You wouldn't find
the,
in a supermarket or
whatever.
So, you know, and I think that's a proper, real nice shopping experience to come across something that is slightly off your radar, something unique, something you want to try. And also, a lot of the time, it's come from a small business.
And local.
And local as well, which
is
really important. Yes, most definitely.
So it's not all doom and gloom out there.
No.
In fact, a lot of it is very, very positive because we're getting these much smaller businesses that are really creating a huge success story, aren't we, in the marketplace?
Yes, and I mean, if people went out and even if they bought two or three items for Christmas gifts for people from somebody that is a small business, then you're really impacting their family because the money they make actually does go on their table and pays for the food that they will eat on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
So, that you know, be mindful of these things. Mm. And they also put love, care and attention into making these things. Mm. And I really quite like the little niche-y, off-the-wall kind of things that I like to sort of put together in a pack for my friends and family. And I, you know, and I know that my money's going to, you know, a well-deserving family that sit there and work very, very hard to create these wonderful things.
So we shouldn't necessarily mourn the loss of these very traditional
businesses that have
been around for hundreds of years necessarily either. We should celebrate the fact that actually there's a whole...
It's giving other people room to be able to be out there on the high street. And I just hope that a lot of the landlords and local authorities step up and assist these
Bring something to the table as well. Well, that's a really interesting point, because there's another article we've been reading about Maidstone reining back on office conversions. So there's obviously been a huge, development land and obviously development space, full stop, has been at a huge premium in town centres and everywhere, frankly. Mm. I mean, there's been a property boom, hasn't there? And so, you know, a lot of traditional office space has been bought by developers, over the last 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it is, and turned into residential property. And I think, is it Maidstone, Tracy? Maidstone, they finally recognise that actually this isn't necessarily, a trend that they want to encourage any more than they already have done.
Exactly. And I think that also smaller spaces gives the opportunity for small businesses to find an office. We have an office in Maidstone. Mm. It's a great unit we're in. Mm-hmm. We've got four or five other businesses there. You know, it's fantastic.
Well, you're in the heart of a residential area. Your building could quite easily be converted into flats, couldn't it?
Oh, most definitely. Mm-hmm. Most definitely. And I think that is a shame because... Mm. If anything like that does happen, there's some fantastic, beautiful historic buildings in Maidstone. Mm. And yes, they would look lovely as apartments and flats. But also, there is still a need for office space for businesses. Mm. And I think that Maidstone Council have obviously realised that they are hitting their targets of the government's plans for housing in the area. And they're obviously now looking at, we need to really slow down the office conversion rates, because I find that a lot of the time it will be building homes and then all of a sudden the trend will change. We need more office space. Mm. Where I live in Sittingbourne, it's ironic that they're now building housing estates on what 100 years ago or even 60 years ago there were housing on that area. Mm. Mm. But then they knocked them all down to create... trading parks.
Yeah.
So,
well, our hosts here, Kent Space, are a great example, aren't they? Mm. I mean, they've just, as well as Ashford and Chatham, they've obviously just opened their Ebbsfleet facility as well.
Which is amazing.
And they were full on day one. Day so, one. You know, there clearly is a huge shortage, you know, catering for that kind of specific market need. But I think it needs to go hand in hand with a much more pragmatic approach to things like business rates.
Yeah.
And that whole system just seems to be, and the way it's calculated and the amount that businesses are being asked to pay just seems to be completely out of kilter with
it's having a massive impact realistic. On cash flow.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is obviously my big thing.
Your mantra.
Mantra. Mm. And, this is what companies do need to consider as well when they're moving into an office space.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's a lot more that can be done for businesses. Mm. But, in a way, I'm glad that Maidstone have taken up this
this
review.
It's a start, isn't it?
Which is a start. Mm. Let's just hope that...
Other areas need to,
Exactly.
Brilliant. Guys, we could talk about the business news for an hour and a half, but we're not going to because we've got two guests that we'd like to talk to as well. I think what we'll do now is we'll play some music by way of an introduction to our first guest. So without further ado, let's do that, and we'll see you on the other side of this.
You're listening to Kent Biz Connect. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Take me tonight, Pepsi, brother, and I'm on fire. Burn my sweet effigy, I'm a roadrunner. Spill my guts on the wheel, I wanna taste.
Fade Kasabian out there, but the show must go on, as they say. Tracy, would you like to enlighten us as to the connection with our next guest, or am I dropping you in it there?
Oh, you always drop me in it. What's unusual about that? But yes, we've got David here from Absolute, and you are in fire electrical safety.
Pretty much right. I'm an electrician by trade, but I specialise in your fire and security safety sides.
Fantastic. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know where to start because it's a massive area. Let's kind of explore those kind of three strands in a bit more detail in terms of the services that you provide, because it's domestic, but it's business at the same time, I guess, isn't it?
Yep, we're quite lucky in the respect that we can work across all three sort of major sectors, so from domestic, commercial and industrial. So we work with anyone and everyone. If you've got a building, we can pretty much work with you.
Okay, so let's start with security.
Okay.
So when we talk about security, what are we talking about? Is it access control systems? Is it CCTV?
Yep, so it's a whole raft of things, really. We cover your intruder alarm, your CCTV, your access control, turnstiles, automatic gates. Pretty much, if it has an electronic pulse and it is a security device, we will look at it and work with you.
Okay. And I would imagine on the kind of security front, that's a business area that's kind of booming at the moment, is it? I mean, everybody talks about the need for for your home to be alarmed, for example, especially at Christmas, with Christmas coming up, but also businesses, crucially. Businesses are very kind of aware of and of their exposure, I think, to, you know, potential kind of outside threat and internal security as well, allowing people access to certain areas in buildings and not others and things like that. So
yeah, and a lot of that is driven by insurance from previous things that have happened. But more and more people are being open to actually wanting security within their business and utilising that security to ensure that data is safe. Because it's not just computer security that you have to worry about. Mm-hmm. It's actually physical people going into an area they shouldn't be in, hence the access control. Mm-hmm. And it's quite common that now people are actively seeking to make sure that their building is secure, not only from outside people that shouldn't be in, but also from their own personnel.
Right, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And there's so much monitoring going on now, isn't there, with swipe cards and things like that, access control. I mean, you know, any business that's kind of a certain size, I guess, has a sort of swipe card system, don't they? And all of that data ultimately is trackable, and they can see people's movements in and around the building and stuff like that.
Yes. Obviously, it would only be able to be accessed by certain people. So if you're the managing director, you would be able to access it. Some IT security people, yep, they'd be able to access it. Not just any Joe Blogs that works for your business, because that would be pretty poor show.
Yeah. Well, what I want to talk about is your kind of... I see you very much as a sort of a customer, a consumer stroke business champion when it comes to ensuring that businesses and people get the right solutions without necessarily having to kind of pay over the odds for something. I mean, you wrote us a very interesting blog recently about fire assessments, for example, fire risk assessments in businesses, which I think all businesses with any kind of premises need to have. Is that right?
Yep, it's a legal requirement that every business that has a building premises must have a fire risk assessment.
Right, but quite often for the business owner, it's about knowing what their options are in respect to getting a bona fide fire risk assessment and actually making sure that they are following, you know, the guidelines and what they need to within that, I guess. And am I right in thinking that in the marketplace, there's a lot of businesses out there or a lot of consultants that perhaps are tied to fire protection companies, for example, who ultimately make their money by selling you equipment that you may not necessarily need? Am I right in thinking that or not?
That's definitely something that goes on. Right. It's a sad part of the industry. And my advice to any consumer is that you look at who you're getting in. It's very easy to use your fire and security company or to come in and do your fire risk assessment, but don't necessarily look at it as an easy out, because it's not ideal. What you really need to do is try and work with your fire alarm company, whoever that may be, and, you know, do talk to them, because the engineers are the all-knowing powers of what you've got on site. And then have an outside fire risk assessor come in, but that isn't tied. It is a complete separate entity, and utilize both and get the right fire safety requirements for your building.
Because so if you get a second opinion, in other words, and an impartial second opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you need to get that impartiality. But also, the fire risk assessor can't know absolutely everything about the fire alarm system, because otherwise they'd be doing what we do.
Yeah.
So the fire professional, the person that comes out each time, every 6 months, usually in a office building, for example, have a chat with that engineer. And you're also then, you're opening that dialogue to find out whether they know what they're doing. Because that's another sad part of the industry, is that not every engineer coming to site may have the full training that required.
Right. So it sounds like, I mean, you would think with something like fire safety, it would be one of the most kind of regulated areas there is, in terms of, you know, the kind of the duty of care that employers have with regard to employees. But it doesn't sound like it necessarily is.
Well, I mean, is it actually they have to have it every 6 months? Is that a legal requirement?
Okay, so the fire risk assessments, no. That's a yearly thing. And in fact, it can actually be broken down to every 5 years.
Oh, okay.
So you still have to have it done yearly, but if you go on a little training course, you can do it yourself.
Right.
Up to the fifth year. The fifth year, you must have a paid professional come in, and that professional should be able to give you the right advice and check your previous four are being done correctly. Right.
And are you finding that that's working, or that you're finding that some businesses, although they've taken up the course and not really been 100%?
Okay, so...
is it fit for purpose? That's what I'm trying to drive at. You know, if somebody goes on one of these courses, are they actually fit enough?
Self-certification, does it work, or...?
It does, but it depends on the individual.
Right.
If you are keen to make sure that your business is running correctly and is safe, then you will actively do it correctly. But in my experience, that's not quite generally what happens. They send a manager or an office junior off to this course. That manager or office junior doesn't necessarily have the same key pointers that you as a director might have, at which point they're not going to fill that form in every year quite in the same way as you would. And then they're not looking at it in the overall picture. The idea of a fire risk assessment is that it ensures that you are running your business and in your building in a safe manner.
Right.
It's not just about all of the other things that go with it. So, for example, you might it encompasses everything. So your bin store, do you store your bins in an appropriate way?
Right.
Do you hold your doors open with fire extinguishers? I mean, that's so common. But actually, that is a life-saving apparatus, if you like. And it's holding a door open, which is also then, if there was a fire, allowing the smoke and flames to come through.
So, is your fire exit blocked by the Christmas tree?
That's for you. You wouldn't believe how many times I've seen that every year.
Yeah.
But yeah, all of these.
So
things.
Where can I go, you know, as a conscientious business owner that's got a business premises, regardless of how many people are in it at any given time, where can I go? Is there like a regulatory body where people that are able to carry out fire risk assessments, is there a code of conduct that, that people have to sign up to and they're regulated on the back of that? Where can I get that impartiality and that, that objectivity that I need that kind of safeguards me against, you know, perhaps someone that really just wants to sell me a whole load of new fire extinguishers or new fire doors or whatever it happens to be?
Okay, so obviously I don't do fire risk assessments, but what I would say is they are all regulated. What my personal feelings are, and the best way to go around it, is look at your fire and security company. If your fire and security company, or in this instance, fire company, as in the ones that come out and do your regular maintenance and check your system over, if they have a fire risk assessor, then don't use them.
Right.
And it's not me trying to abuse businesses. I'm sure they're great, but there is always that potential for bias. Someone like myself, we don't have a fire risk assessor. So if you came to me and said, oh, I need a fire risk assessment, the only thing I can do is recommend you on.
Right.
There's no benefit to me in recommending you to someone that's not going to do their job properly. But there's also no benefit to me. They're not going to come back to me and use me as the company that needs to repair something that's broken necessarily because I've push the job away. So anything like that's great. There are lots of articles online. And there's, I think it's the Fire Risk Association, which you can also find online. And they will have teams of people that in your local area that you can use. And then it's just a case of looking at that research and checking against them. Do they have other divisions? And and then whether it's worth using them or not.
And I guess you could always ask the fire brigade, could you? Because I know the fire brigade are very active in the kind of business community. I mean, they probably are they a good kind of option in the first instance, or would they be able to kind of refer you and signpost you to the right place? Or
possibly, I've never had that experience, so I can't actively state whether they would or not. They do have their own fire officers, so if they've got time, they might even pop in and give you some sort of safety. It wouldn't necessarily mean that you've complied because you've had a fire officer visit.
No.
So you still need to do your risk assessment. But I would highly recommend you just have a look around, and when you find someone, just triple check that they don't have any sort of bias, as in they're not connected to another company or whatever, and ask them direct, because people really struggle in the face of, are you connected to a fire alarm company? They don't want to say no, but they won't want to necessarily say yes, and you'll know straight away.
Yeah, and I guess if you are spending lots of money, just do your due diligence in terms of getting, you know, two or three quotes in, and because it can be quite an expensive area, I would imagine. And, you know, when you start replacing, you know, tens of fire extinguishers, I'd imagine it all kind of adds up, doesn't it? It can be quite a costly investment.
And that's another reason to check a couple of different people, because invariably you might have your alarm company or your extinguisher company or whoever it is coming in, and they're telling you you need to do X, Y, and Z. Mm. You might then find that another company comes in and says, you don't need to do any of that, or you need to do this, but not that. Mm-hmm. And then it's, you've got this two options. One, you've got this really big bill that might be right, might be not. Mm. And another one, which is a lot less, but might be right, might be not. And you're left holding that can. Which one do you take?
Yeah.
Getting a third option, or even talking to your fire risk assessor, will give you the answer to what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, okay. So where do you come in? Where does Absolute come in terms of you know, that fire safety space? What how do you work with businesses specifically?
Okay, so what we firstly do is, once we get someone approach us, whatever their requirements may be, obviously it's a fire risk assessment, we will pass that information on.
So you don't do those?
Mm-hmm. No, we don't do any fire risk assessments, and we have no intention of, because it's a bias. Mm-hmm. What we will do is, we'll come in, we'll do a survey of your building. Mm-hmm. We're specifically looking for anything like your fire alarms, mm-hmm. any sort of early warning detection system. So that could be, depending on the type of site you have, gas suppression, air sampling. There's a range of products that are all part of that early warning detection. Once we've done a survey, we'll price it to maintain it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, once you've had that maintenance cost, hopefully you'll come to us and you'll utilise us, and we'll then do what's called a takeover service. Mm-hmm. That is where we do and test of absolutely everything that links back to that system. And anything off the back of that report, we provide you. So we say, look, you know, this smoke detector number 22, loop one, doesn't work, or was slow to respond. It's quite common. And from that, you have a choice to replace it or not. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's not working, you have a duty of care to your employees, your customers, whoever it is, to have that replaced.
Mm. So the fire risk assessment, for example, would flag up the fact that you need to have smoke detectors throughout the building, for example, in every single office, in every single space, there needs to be a smoke detector. So that would be a requirement as part of a fire risk assessment. Whether or not that actually works in practice is kind of is where you come in, and you can advise companies to say, actually, you know, you've already done your fire risk assessment, you've ticked that box, and that's all good. But, you know, now that we've come in and actually audited all of your kind of infrastructure, some of it is fine and other bits of it aren't. And you now need to decide where you're going to kind of prioritise investment and to bring things up to scratch, I guess.
Yeah, and often we utilise the fire risk assessment because all fire alarm systems are done on a grade.
Yeah.
L1 to L5 or P1 to P2, depending on the type of building it is. So if the fire risk assessor says that the building should be an L2, for example, but we walk in and we look at it and we see, well, there's not enough detection to comply to L2,
right?
Then automatically we're going to come to you and say, look, your risk assessment says L2.
Yeah.
You currently stand at L3.
Yes.
So we need to add X to make it L2.
Yes. But the difference with you is you're not fire risk assessor and solution provider under the same, you know, wearing the same hat.
100%.
And so therefore, if it only needs to be L2 as opposed to L5 or the other way around, you'll tell businesses that that's, you know, that's what it needs to be, rather than trying to sell them a Rolls Royce perhaps, when actually all they need is a, is a, I don't know, a mini or a transit van.
That's a very good analogy, but yes, basically.
It's fitness for purpose. And yeah, okay. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Now, I want to touch on something that's perhaps a little bit still incredibly sensitive, I would suggest, and that's what happened at Grenfell.
Okay.
Because I know that you were very involved after that event in terms of making sure that that kind of thing can't happen again from a kind of a basic fire alarm system and kind of process viewpoint. So just talk us through how you got involved with some of that and what you actually did. I mean, what was the, you know, what some of the key findings were ultimately?
Okay, so obviously there's blame somewhere, but I don't think there's blame to one individual person, company or anything like that. I think it's a failing within our industry as a whole. The fire risk assessors walk in, they go in and they assess an individual premises. That assessment then needs to be looked at by someone like myself, who then protects that building to that risk assessment.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is, and it's long been standing, this stay put policy, and it's a difficult one to say whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. There are benefits in both ways. The problem with a stay put policy instantly means that you can't have sounders on a fire alarm. So you have this early warning device that then does not warn. And it sounds crazy, but what it does is it actually opens windows to allow ventilation of smoke. And that's a really good thing. But in the instance of Grenfell, the smoke was already on the staircase.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how you look at it, the smoke wasn't clearing from that staircase. So whether you encourage stay put policies or not, you've got this definitive issue where no one, even if they could have got out and were not running on a stay put policy, the staircase was full of smoke. And there's various different reasons to that. And probably haven't got time to go through it all, but fire doors, really key, important thing. They get damaged. They get left open by fire extinguishers. They might not have closed properly. I mean, there's not a full report that I've seen so far that says every individual part that failed. So the way I can see it and the way I work towards it is I like to work with a fire risk assessor that is completely impartial to me. I don't even need to know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
We look at that fire risk assessment, and then if I've got questions from that,
mm-hmm.
I will quite happily phone that fire risk assessor up mm-hmm. and question them to it.
Right.
And I will always have in the back of my mind this stay put policy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a fan of it personally,
mm-hmm.
especially in high rise blocks such as Grenfell. And the reason being is you cannot understand how that building will burn in the same way as if you witness it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never witnessed a true fire other than what we saw on TV.
Yeah.
Fire risk assessors, in most part, haven't.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this sort of disconnect between the fire authorities, so the fire brigade, fire risk assessors, and then fire protection people such as myself.
Mm.
And I think what we really need to do is try and bridge that link so that we all work as together.
Mm.
And then we can start looking at what went wrong.
Mm.
And it's not, to me, it's not a blame game. Mm. The issue's happened. It's been and gone. What we need to do is stop it from happening again.
Yes.
And look at a raft of things. And there were so many failings.
Mm.
To have a building that went up in the same way as Grenfell was a complete catastrophe.
Mm. It was a shock, I think, to everybody that actually saw it, because even
terrific, wasn't it?
Even the fire brigade said it went up so quick. Mm. And excuse me. I think that also, and I've been reading quite a lot of things about it, because there's been a lot of, you know, social media blame game thing, and I think it's tragic what happened, but a lot of bravery as well. And I was interested in hearing about your stay put policy, because I read an article about when these flats were originally built. They were originally built as a flat was a unit. But obviously, because you've covered it in this material, It's from the outside in, whereas if it was inside...
The panelling, yeah.
It wouldn't have really spread to the rate it had.
Mm.
And looking, and you're going up and down the country as I do, I see a lot of buildings, especially going up in London, with, I mean, I don't know if it's the same material, but similar looking material on office blocks, etc. And to me, it's quite worrying to make sure that, you know, it does look nice when it's all built and it's all fresh and everything else, but is there hidden dangers within the materials that are used? And I can understand that for fire protection from your side and the brigades as well, it was quite a horrific thing to watch.
Yeah. I mean, there were accusations of cost cutting there, weren't there, in terms of the specification of the panels.
But I think that you're right that, you know, within a lot of things that happen after the event, people say, well, we should have all spoken to one another because then it would never have happened at this magnitude. And it's
but the architects as well, they're an important part of that, that closing that loop, aren't they? Because they designed the fire safety specification in the first instance, I would imagine.
Well, actually, to be fair, what most architects do is they design a building. Then they go out to various different companies. So buildings that size would have gone out to a major refit.
Yeah.
That refit company then has a specification guidance and they then go to the suppliers. And it's that point you've got sort of three people in the chain then.
Yes.
And suddenly you are losing that sort of communication.
Stuff's getting
lost. Ideally, the supplier needs to talk to the architect as well as the builder or the main contractor in the middle to make sure that everyone is supplying what they should be supplying.
I think we'll move on from fire because I want to talk about something a little bit more cheery. And that's Christmas.
Okay.
And I'd like your sort of pearls of wisdom for everybody listening when it comes to staying safe at Christmas when you get those Christmas lights out of the loft that have been handed down from the generation to generation. I know I've got some. My mum prides herself on these baubles that she hangs on the tree every year that have been passed down literally over 100 years or so. And I think the lights, most of them go with that as well. So, Dave, how can we stay safe at Christmas? How can we make sure that we come back to a home when we leave it and we inadvertently leave the Christmas lights on?
Okay, well, the first and foremost, don't just switch your sockets off with your Christmas tree lights plugged in. Take the plug out.
Right.
Believe it or not, that switch, it only turns the live feed off. It doesn't turn the neutral or the earth off.
Okay.
So make sure you unplug it.
Something new I didn't know.
Now, what does that actually mean, though?
So if you unplug it, it physically has no connection to your electricity in the house whatsoever. Okay. If it's plugged in, it still has a connection.
So why would that be a problem?
If you've got a problem with your lighting, your Christmas tree lighting, and it's continually got that feed, but you've turned your switch off, you don't have the same safeties coming through from your fuse board to isolate the circuit because that switch is already turned off.
Yeah.
So it's just about, a really, really important thing, if it looks right, it probably is. And if it doesn't look right, it probably isn't.
Right.
For years, my parents had a set of tree lights that went into a connector block and that powered four different types of lights.
Yes.
And it didn't look right.
No.
And it wasn't right. And I'll be honest with you, I mean, they never had a fire from it, but they did always take the plug out.
Yes.
But yeah, it's just about...
So they never left it unattended.
Effectively, yeah. And it's just simple things like that. And I'll say what my arch enemy is, four-way adapters. If you have four-way adapters going into four-way adapters...
Hundreds of those.
Yeah, they're horrific.
Yeah.
They're not my...
They always come out at Christmas
as
well.
They do.
I've got one by my front door. My wife loves to plug in one of these little fibre optic Christmas trees by the front door so that people from the street can see it. It's like, why? And then, of course, that means that the phone and I've got all sorts of stuff coming in by the front door. All of that ends up going into one of these...
It's not like... As an individual unit, it's okay. As long as you've bought it from a bona fide supplier, don't go and get these Chinese ones that have come in. But it's when you plug one into the other, into the other, into the other, and you've suddenly got six four-ways all going into one socket.
Okay.
That's a really dangerous mix.
So not one necessarily.
No, one. I mean, I'm not a fan of them.
No.
But we can't have a million sockets in your house. I mean, I'd love to, but, you know.
I tell you the other thing that I end up doing as a result of that, there's always one that is awkward to get the wire in. You know, the wire coming out the bottom of the plug interferes with the four-way connector.
It's got one of them hot, you know... It's not flexible.
No, it's like a hard bit. So you end up bending it to get it.
Well, I wouldn't dare do anything like that, connector. Martin. But
and of course, that might be breaking the connection. I guess might be breaking the insulation. Might, you know, anything. Mm. So
and the other thing to consider, I mean, there's lovely people out there. They do a lot for charity, and they put a lot of lights and all Christmas decorations all over their house.
Yeah.
How are they supplying that feed to all of those supplies? I mean, Your fuse board as it comes in is hopefully a fairly new one with an RCD protecting.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got all of this stuff that you don't normally have on your house, and all of a sudden you're loading your house with all of this electronic equipment.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what? You're so right, because mine actually, many, many years ago, and I've got to say the electricity board were out, you know, like that, it caught fire. Before it had that new fuse boarding
RCD,
I had an old one, and it did actually, while we were in the house one night, it physically caught fire. And I would, you know, and there must still be properties out there that have got exactly that setup.
Yeah. And it's not that it's non-compliant anymore. I mean, we wouldn't fit it now. It is non-compliant to today's standards.
Yes.
But it complied to those standards back then.
Yeah.
So regular testing and maintenance of your electrical system is a must anyway.
Right.
Whether it's homes, businesses or whatever.
And
not just for Christmas.
Yes.
Yeah. Just generally check your system over and have it looked at by an electrician.
Yes.
And just make sure that everything you've done before you overload something is actually safe to do so.
Yeah.
I mean, most electricians would probably love to come out and fit some Christmas tree lights for you and... Yeah. You know, maybe go up on the roof and put some lighting up on the roof for you.
Yeah.
But leave it safe so that your house isn't going to burn down when you're not in it.
So the rule of thumb there is to unplug everything before you 100%. Go down the pub.
If in doubt, unplug.
Yeah.
Especially the Christmas tree lights. I'm not talking about TVs. and
if in serious doubt, don't even plug in. Dave, we could talk forever about this, especially with Christmas coming up and just around the corner. So for those of us out there that clearly do need your advice and your impartial expertise, how can we get in touch with Absolute?
Okay, via email, info@aefs-uk.com. Phones 01622 437 838. And if you want to talk to me direct, 07823 774 725.
Direct line.
So you're Maidstone based by the sounds of it, 01622.
Yep.
But you cover obviously the whole of Kent, and you've got quite a big team as well, I know. So
Yeah, we've got a reasonable sized team now. Yeah. But we cover a larger area. We don't just cover Kent, we cover Kent, Surrey, Sussex, well. Essex, London, everywhere.
Fantastic. Wow. Good. All right. So stay safe out there, people. And if in doubt, give Dave a ring at Absolute Group. So, Dave, for now, thank you so much
for
coming on the show. I think what we need to do, Trace, is play a bit more music.
Yes.
By way of an introduction to our next guest, Mo. So, without further ado, that's what we're going to do, and we'll see you on the other side of this. Tracy.
Oh, hello.
We nearly missed our cue then. We were so engrossed in fire safety and who to talk to and how to go about it. We nearly missed our cue. The song ended.
We did, yes.
And we didn't come in. So you chose that. So please explain yourself.
Well, we've got Mo here from Far Signs in Maidstone.
There you go.
Fabulous guy. Can I just say, I've just been Googling you.
Thank you.
Yes, and seeing some of the amazing stuff that you actually do. So I'm really interested to find out a bit more about what Far Signs is about. And obviously the Lincoln song there was Ace of Base, I Saw the Sign.
Yeah. Well, we were going to play Lawrence of Arabia, which I felt was far more fitting. But, you know, budget cuts and what have you means that unfortunately we don't have the theme tune from Lawrence of Arabia on our system. But Mo, welcome to the show. The reason we wanted to play Lawrence of Arabia is, of course, because you are originally from Jordan.
Yes, I'm originally from Jordan.
A beautiful country,
yeah,
may I say. And in fact, knowing that you were coming on the show, I watched the film again at the weekend just to remind myself of the beautiful Wadi Rum.
Wadi Rum, yes.
Wadi Rum and Petra, which yep. some more people will probably recognise as one of the locations for Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
Yes.
So welcome to the show. It's so nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
You are the proprietor of Far Signs Maidstone. We were talking before we came on air about how signage isn't necessarily as simple as people think. So we were talking about the fact that a lot of business owners think they need one thing and they're actually buying a product when what they really need is advice to help them get the best solution for their business. So just explain a little bit about what we mean by that, Mo.
Yeah, actually is, as we discussed before the show, it's a matter of solution more than just a product. It's not something you just come and you say, I want to buy this kind of sign and that's all. Mm. You need to look for many things that, is it a suitable solution for you? Is it the right one? This is what you need. Sometimes some customers, they discuss something and they found what they request is more than what they required.
Right.
In the opposite side, some of them is requesting something and we found that they need more actually to attract because the sign is part from the marketing. This is the major thing. It's not just a place to say, yeah, this is the name of the shop or the name of the office. It's actually a marketing. It's your brand. Mm-hmm. It's you show your brand, you show your logo. So it's something really important to think about.
So having spent all that money creating a brand identity, for example, and translating that across all touch points of your business, to then skimp on the execution of that with poor signage just kind of defeats the object, I guess, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's actually, there is for example, some people, they request illuminated 3D sign, mm-hmm. which is high specs luxury sign. Mm-hmm. And when we make a site visit to check about it, it's unuseless because maybe they are not in Main Road, for example. It will be hidden by trees from your neighbors, so nobody will see your sign. it's a lot of things. And we had many experiences with this. We find that a customer requests a solution cost £4,000-£5,000. And after we made the site visit, we found 800 or 900 quid is more than enough what he needs as a solution to transfer his message.
Yeah.
Do you know there is a fact, actually, it's saying that is 86 from sales decisions or purchasing decisions in the retailer shop, it's built by your signs. It's how the sign of the shop outside, the first impression.
Right.
Then when you get inside, if you are a consumer, and you find difficulty to walk inside, you will leave early. You will not decide. You will for thought where I will find something.
So it doesn't just stop outside. It's the navigation around the shop inside. Can I find what I'm looking for quickly? Because let's face it, It's very rare that you can find a shop assistant these days to actually give you...
To give you directions.
Yeah, or even the time of day, frankly. For that, they don't seem interested.
No. For that, they make actually analysis about it, and they found that 86% from the decision is built on that.
Yes.
And so you need to take care about it.
Right.
But the problem that... most of the customers, they always decide about it in the last minute.
Yes.
And always they see the invest in it is not really worth it. But actually, the main thing you have to look for it is reflecting your brand. It's your image. So how you want your image to appear and the people remember it in the future.
I mean, I'm terrible. Whenever I go into a big store, any kind of store, I can never find what I'm looking for quickly. You know, and I always resort to, you know, trying to find someone to ask them where this is or where that is. And I think it's just, as you say, it's just poor information in store. You know, I mean, I went and bought some, a replacement windscreen wiper for my wife's car recently from a well-known retailer of high street, effectively retailer of car parts where you can buy bicycles and all sorts of other stuff. And could I find the windscreen wipers in this stock? Could I, hell?
No, it's like supermarkets. Oh. You go there every week. You know exactly where everything is. Mm. And then you rock up one week.
They change it.
And go, well, where's the bread gone?
Yeah.
Where's the eggs gone?
It's actually take us to two things, actually. The sign is not only, it's a directional to tell you where is something. It's even, it's a message.
Yes.
You transfer a message through the sign because even the wall graphics is a message. Mm. For example, in the offices, to put motivation words or motivation drawings or something like that.
Yeah.
It's make effect in the environment of the work. Even we was working, talking about the safety. Last few minutes, actually, there is a safety signs, and even the safety signs itself, there is a regulations about it. There is a certain criteria about it, about the sizes, the material. Even when you look for it, based on where it will be installed. So, if it's industrial building, if it's residential building, there is a certain regulations, and you need to know as a supplier all these regulations.
Yeah.
So it's not matter of customer. He came, he said, "Yeah, I want fire exit sign." It's not simple as that. We need to know more details about it to give you the right solution. Mm. Otherwise, okay, both of them, it looks fire exit. But what if something has happened? There is a regulation about it. You want to be in safe. I want to be in safe.
Mm, mm.
The other side is as I told you, it's a message. The idea of the sign is to transfer something you think about it.
I really like that idea.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about how many businesses do you walk into? I mean, Kent Space are one of the few exceptions, actually, when they have they're actually using their wall space to communicate not just, you know, individual office names, but also messages about, you know, what they're all about as a business and their core values and ethos and everything else. But how many businesses actually take the time to do that, to communicate powerful kind of thoughts like that and information?
It's actually, if I want to divide them, usually these kind of things, I think the corporate companies more attract in these things because they know the meaning of their brand, actually.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For the SME businesses, for that we are here, actually, to help them how to make this one.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of projects for SMEs businesses, and we were so proud that we transferred the message which they wanted, because we guide you as about based on your requirements.
Mm-hmm.
We plus that we provide it as a complete solution. So this is another thing. It's important.
Yeah,
there is some of suppliers. Let's say they cannot supply everything at the same time.
Mm.
Okay, and they didn't connect it to each other, but or the solution itself or the product, because they consider it is just a sign, like a product.
Yes.
It's like you go to the shop and you buy a pen, for example.
Yeah, like a commodity. Yeah.
Yeah, but in general, we are a solution provider. For that, it's part from our names. We called visual communications. This is exactly where we are.
Yeah. And you've got some great case studies, because I know we all, certainly three of us, meet regularly at K-Sports in Maidstone, don't we, for some networking. And I know you've been very involved with them in terms of communicating their rebrand when the business was bought.
I'm just looking at that actually on the website, and it looks smart.
But you've got digital signage solutions in there as well, haven't you?
Yes.
So it is really kind of looking at the business and what the business needs, as opposed to kind of looking at a product and saying, I need a digital screen.
Yeah, this is another part, actually. You know, the technology is developed very fast. In the old days, they were saying that no signs anymore, which it's not true. You still need the sign. Mm. But in that time, they were saying the digital will be everything. Mm. To be honest, digital is important, and it's increased the brand about it is digital is really helpful.
Yes.
Okay. But at the same time, it's like the sign. If you didn't choose it correctly, it will be useless, because it's not matter of a screen. Okay. It's a matter of the content itself.
Right.
What you will present the inside message. The screen. Mm. And the other thing is, most of the people, they thought, if he buy a TV from any shop, it will do the job, which it's the TV is not designed to be a digital sign. There is a special requirements for that.
Yeah.
And we are proud the last, before 2 weeks, we did something. I think we are the first in Maidstone. We have a solution. We convert any glass you want. If you have a front shop or something, we can convert it to a TV. Mm-hmm. A real digital TV, which it's anyone with any size, by the way. So what we did, it was a screen 2 meter by 1.5 meter. If you want to buy a real digital screen for this, it will cost you really a fortune.
Yes,
it costs you 8,000-9,000 plus an installation cost, where this kind of solution is cost you £600 to £900, depend on the size of the screen. But this is one of the things. So the idea is not the screen itself. First of all, the cost-effective solution, let's say. Do you need this kind? Even your shop, how you will install it. Because in some shops, if you want to install the digital screen, there is some criteria if the people, they will work in this area. Some of them, even it's come, we call it interactive, which it's mean the people themselves, they can touch it. They can, like the mall, for example. Yes. If you go, you can touch till you, where is your direction. So we think, as far as science, digital screens is something need, it's the future, real future. It's make a change. And by the way, as to researchers, they say that 59% from your sales could be increased if you convert to digital screens to show your product. Like today, for example, go to McDonald's. McDonald's, when you go, all the menus is live.
Yeah.
So it's actually more active with your brain. So it's make a difference about your decision.
Yes. Do you know what? That infuriates me, that does, because then the experience doesn't translate into the person behind the counter who's ultimately then giving you your order. That's where I find the disconnect exists. You know, yes, you've got this wonderful technology that allows you to order in seconds what you want, but then you're still find yourself trying to make eye contact with the person behind the counter to make sure that you get the order that you've just placed on this wonderful digital screen. But I was thinking of another example, actually, where it might have been really powerful. Think of travel agents. I walked past my local Thomas Cook on Friday, which is now closed down. And it was really sad to see yet another traditionally strong high street brand no longer there. But if I think about how they used to sell their last minute holidays, and things like that, they were on these horrible little cards that they used to stick in the window, and it used to say Alicante from £59 or, whatever it is. And I'm thinking, it's so out of date. It's so not in keeping with today. And they could have had a digital sign on there, couldn't they, that would have actually been flashing up with the latest kind of flight deal or exchange rate or holiday offer, that would have been so much more engaging than having a flat bit of cardboard that somebody's just kind of written on Lanzarote from 159 or whatever.
Yeah, it's absolutely right what you said. It's I think it's it's related to the customer themselves. Still, there is big percent from the customers. They didn't believe about the marketing budget that it should be done.
Yeah.
Like, for example, there are some customers, you meet them, they are retailers. They take care about the shelves, what kind of things he want to put on these shelves, which it's absolutely right.
Yeah.
But in the opposite, you need something to bring the customer, to tell them there is something inside.
That's my point. That's exactly my point. They've got this wonderful shop front, you know, a travel agent. And but they don't use it, do they? They don't use it as a marketing weapon, you know, to kind of to capture people's attention as they're walking down the high street.
No, there is a nice thing which from experience I see it live. Actually, I remember before many years when Dubai they opened this the biggest mall in the world. Mm-hmm. Okay, everybody was talking about it. How you will walk inside, you will lost. Mm. Which it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Okay. If you park in a place, okay, maybe you will lose your car.
Yes.
Okay.
It's so
and
big.
Which it's happened with me, actually. Yeah. I parked and I forget where I parked.
Yeah.
But, you know, when they opened it, it was a nice opening. You know, after, I think, 2-3 months, they installed such kind of digital things, okay, which it's remember exactly where you are.
Yes.
So it's like a directional.
Yes.
Okay, but it's not a standard sign.
Yeah.
In the opposite side, you can save it in some certain locations.
Yeah.
In the opposite side, you can print like a receipt, okay, to tell you which zone you are. So still whatever has happened to you, you can retain back.
Ah,
which is something so important about the directional. This is related to directional. Okay, it's costly now for such a mall it needs that.
Yes.
This is another part of the solution. Yeah. Do you need it or not?
But you're right. I mean, I was in France this summer and I remember shopping at the Super U in just outside the big hypermarket. I think it's a Super U. Just outside,
a really bad
that was my
French.
Just outside Antibes, huge hypermarket. But it's not just a hypermarket, it's also loads of other shops built around the hypermarket. Mm. Now, French hypermarkets are enormous. Could I find it?
No.
I parked in what I thought was the Super U car park. I then went looking for the Super U to go shopping. I couldn't even find the thing. I mean, it's the biggest supermarket you've ever seen in your life. And I couldn't even find it because the signage was that bad. All they had was big doors opening into a foyer.
Yeah.
But no, the Super U is that way, by the way, Mr. White, or nothing like that. I had to ask people where it was. And this is a hypermarket that sells millions of products.
Yeah, it's...
I couldn't even find it.
It's when you decide about sign, it's, as I said before, it's not something just you want to put it. You have to think about it.
Mm.
Even sometimes in our work, when we make 3D illuminated sign, there is a challenge in every sign. It's not a standard thing. You can do it. First of all, you need to be sure this is the right requirement for the customer. What kind of material? This is another thing.
Mm.
Because if we talk about raw material itself, okay, is another part from this business, which it's need really to know about it more and more. And you need to, when you start to design and fabricate it, even if it looks typically to you, to the consumer, but internally for us is not typically, there is a lot of things involved about it in the raw material, in the kind of the lights, in the solution itself, in the sizes. There's a lot of things about it.
Right.
So it's important that the customer, they need always to think that the sign is not just a decoration. It's a message.
Mm.
It's a message that you want to transfer to your consumer or to your audience, okay? And you need the right people to tell you how to transfer it correctly.
Yeah. So when you say you want a diamond cut steel sign that's going to cost thousands of pounds, you do realize, Mr. Customer, that when you leave it outside for 6 months, it's actually going to go rusty. It's going to go red, you know, and it's going to, you know, with oxidization or whatever, and it's going to look completely different.
Yeah, it's actually, this is another part we do it in Fast Signs. We always try to educate the customer. It's not a part of selling.
Mm.
We always try to advise the customer, give him the right advice.
Mm.
Sometimes I had some customers, they was asking me, we get your quotation, for example, and they get it from somebody, and there is a big difference in the price.
Yeah.
I told him I need to know the specs.
Yes.
Because I can't design the same sign, okay, the same output or the same finished product in different ways.
Yes.
It's a matter of what kind of the requirement, where it will be installed, internal, external.
Yeah.
A lot of things is involved about it.
Yeah.
So it's not something that you will find it everywhere.
That must be infuriating for businesses like yours. When you know, when somebody gives you a quotation and says to you, yours is three times as much as theirs, and you think, well, you know, where's the specification? Where, you know, we're not comparing like for like. It's, you know, it's apples and pears. It's, you know, it's whatever.
It's difficult part, to be honest with you. But it's, if you like this kind of work, you will enjoy about it.
Right, okay.
Because it's nice to talk about it. We had
You like to educate the customer.
Yeah, we had nice customers. Mm. We built the relation with them because of that.
Yes.
They start to, even we reach a level with them, we have the order by default.
Yes.
Because they trust that
they trust
we
you.
Give them about what they need exactly. Sometimes, like this customer, it's, I remember they came in one solution and I told them, it's, you doesn't need, you don't need this kind of thing. I think, I suggest an idea. And I was so happy that the customer said, see, I trust you, I trust your company. Whatever you see it's suitable for us, just do it.
Right.
Don't even come to me. Just I need to know how much money I will pay and that's all.
Yeah.
So this is something really nice when you deal with your customer, especially if you educate them about what they need.
Yeah.
And as Fast Signs, this is the policy. This
That's
is
what
one
you do.
Of,
yeah.
This is all the Fast Signs network. Yes. Yeah. We work in the same way.
Yeah.
For that, we have a really a nice accounts, let's say, with big names. Like Fast Signs, we work with Amazon. Mm-hmm. We work with Madame Tussauds Museum, London Eye. So Fast Signs as a group, it's we have like a model and ethical work.
Yes.
What kind, we have approved supplier, everything is checked by the franchisor, everything is approved by them, what do we need? And
you're a professional outfit.
Exactly, exactly.
Mo, how can we help local businesses in Kent put their trust and faith in you for their signage solutions? How can people get in touch with you? What's the best way?
They can contact us by email, which it's very simple, maidstone@fastscience.com, because we are loyal for Maidstone. And they can contact us through our through the phone.
Yes.
Okay, where we have our consultants to answer, which it's 06-0162-672-844. If they need direct contact with me, they can contact me on my mobile. We are always available to answer, which it's 0774596534. And they
you're on the Twitter as well.
We are on Twitter, Facebook.
Yeah,
we are active online, even in our website. If you have anything required, we can answer directly. And
but
remember,
I think the point is, you know, get in touch and get advice rather than kind of coming to you with a preconceived idea of what the what the product is, you know, come to you for a solution rather than a product costing.
At any time, if they want any advice, it doesn't matter if they will buy or not. If they need a real advice about what they want, we are always available. This is why we are there, because Fast Signs is not just a sign. We are more than fast, more than signs.
Guys, fascinating as always. Tracy, thank you so much for co-hosting today. Thank you to
it's
our wonderful guests.
Thank you.
Dave and Mo. We do have to end it there, sadly. We will, however, be back in 2 weeks' time with the bearded one, perhaps, if they let him back in, which they may not do. But in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. This has been Kent Biz Connect, and we will be on the air in 2 weeks' time. Thank you.